This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Home in a box on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. Once again, we are back to discuss movies in general, just to have fun. We've got a couple of good ones this week that we're going to have fun with. And as usual, it might be contentious, and that's what we want to bring to the table. Just deep discussion of genre films, whether it be action, horror, sci-fi, you know, your cult films. This is the place for them. Go home in the box. I am your host, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where last week I reviewed Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy. Quite an interesting film from a production standpoint. I enjoyed it quite easily. You can find that review online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week I'll be reviewing Joel Schumacher's Flatliners, also from 1990. Time has not been good to this movie. This was a film I enjoyed quite a bit when it actually first came out, but we'll see how it goes in the review. Check it out, RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, is my co-conspirator in this little program. He is the Ayatollah of pop cultura, Joel LaPuma. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I hate Warren Beatty, but I totally sympathize with your feelings on Dick Tracy's production design.
Yeah, it was a very good-looking film, and I didn't mind Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy so much. I had more of an issue with Madonna as Breathless Mahoney, but you got to have someone who can sing, right?
And how else were you going to get like young people to watch a Dick Tracy movie in 1990?
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, gosh, that comic strip debuted in like 1930 or 31, so at that point, Dick Tracy's like 60 years old.
Just the right age for Warren Beatty to have grown up idolizing him.
Absolutely. So, and that was a movie that actually got stuck in, development hell for quite a while before Warren Beatty finally blew the dust off of it and got it moving. So,
the one time he didn't screw over the production of a big film.
Yeah, not a fan of Warren Beatty's, but I think he did everything right with Dick Tracy personally. So
it was kind of a fun little romp. As much as it's not a great movie, but it's not an unenjoyable one. And I've sort of delayed my own entrance. I'm Joel, and you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And now I'm tempted to write an article about why I hate Warren Beatty.
Go ahead. Do it.
I'm very tempted. Maybe I'll just do one on how he turned a stupid romantic comedy into like an $80 million budget disaster with Town and Country.
Yeah. I haven't seen Town and Country, I think mainly because of all the bad stuff I heard about it, and I think I've avoided it for that reason.
So the story behind it's going to be way more interesting than anything in the film.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll read up on it. To Wikipedia, Joel.
That's what we're here for.
So, what you got going on, Joel?
Oh, not terribly much lately. Just kind of delving into bad 80s horror paperbacks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So, So I hope to see something interesting on Razor Candy with that very soon, man, because I enjoyed the last one.
I've made the mistake of actually reading some of these books lately. It's not it's not going well. I had to run back to Algernon Blackwood for safety.
Oh, man. For safety?
Safety from the lack of quality, I guess. I mean, I'm not trying not to be a snob. It's just like, some of the stuff is just so awful.
Yeah, well, I'm still on my anti-Netflix crusade. I know that
I'm really
they,
enjoying that.
Yeah, I know that they, we're still going through the fallout of Stranger Things Season 2, but now they've thrown the Punisher on top of it. And, but last time I looked, I still couldn't find Death Spa on Netflix. And so that's really sticking in my craw, so I'm still, over at RetroMovieNerd.com, I'm still producing my weekly piece of what am I watching this week, where I find a trio of movies on Amazon Prime, which is just a deep catalog of stuff. And so if anyone's a cinephile, you know, if you're listening to this, you probably are a cinephile, and if you're wanting a streaming service with a deep catalog of movies, you're not really going to find it on Netflix, so head on over to Amazon Prime and check out what they got, because you really won't be disappointed. So, but that's my Netflix rant for yet another show. But we got a whole slew of stuff to talk about on this show, Joel. As always, we'll start with the new releases, our new retro releases coming out. Now, we didn't have a show last week, so got a couple of weeks to play catch up with here. Let's start with stuff that was released this past week, the week of November 14th release date. First thing that pops out is Universal cashing in once again with a four-movie collection of the Psycho series. And I'm pretty sure that they've done this before, and we know that they're probably going to do it again and within the next 5 or 6 years. So if you're a fan of the Psycho films, and really there are quite a few of them out there, I mean, they're, in my opinion, they are quite decreasing in quality with each subsequent one. And certainly, by the end of the series, it certainly makes you forget the greatness of the original Psycho. I guess there's something for everyone out there, and for Psycho fans, we have a four-movie collection from Universal.
There's not really much to say. I mean, I think Scream Factory did all the sequels at some point in the past few years. So if you have interest in the Psycho sequels, it's probably safer to just get the Scream Factory releases and have some nice special features and quality there. You know, if you're interested in Anthony Perkins, you know, there's a very underrated movie he did back in 68, I believe, Pretty Poison, that I would absolutely recommend if you can track down a copy.
Right.
Really great sort of lovers on the run kind. It's not quite Bonnie and Clyde. It's not that romanticized. It's, you know, a couple of fragile temperaments, like, conflicting, and chaos results from it. It's a really fascinating little film, and Perkins is awesome in it. I would recommend that instead.
Very good. Yeah. I guess, like you said, there's not much else to be said about a Psycho four movie collection from the Beast Universal. But there are other releases to check out. For instance, Arrow Video is putting out a George Romero collection called Between Night and Dawn, which includes Blu-ray versions of his 1971 drama, his follow-up to Return of the Living Dead, actually. There's Always Vanilla. Basically, it just seems to be about a story about a young drifter and his model girlfriend and their relationship, which shouldn't work in the first place. And then from 1972, there's Season of the Witch, not to be confused with Halloween 3. Season of the Witch, originally filmed as Jack's Wife, but released to theaters under the title Hungry Wives, follows the exploits of a housewife whose dissatisfaction with her humdrum life leads to an unhealthy interest in the occult. Now, what's so unhealthy about the occult, Joel? Seriously.
I think it's just what you do with it.
it's all in what you do with it, man. And then 1973, also in this collection, The Crazies. Now, there shouldn't be anyone who's a fan of movies that does not know about The Crazies. Romero, you know, after There's Always Vanilla and Season of the Witch, kind of Romero kind of returns to the horror territory with The Crazies. Small rural town in the middle of a virus, an infection, which makes people turn homicidal and violent. And this was more of what George Romero was good at with horror. The Crazies, not quite a zombie movie, but it's almost similar in tone. And it's probably one of behind the original Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead is probably next on my list of George Romero in terms of my own personal likes. I would place this third on my George Romero list, Joe.
Yeah, you know, Romero's always great at sort of rapidly expanding and folding chaos. I haven't seen There's Always Vanilla or Season of the Witch, but Season of the Witch really interests me because it almost seems like an early version of what he was doing with Martin. You know, that sort of cross between a mundane setting and a supernatural fixation.
Yeah,
I find that really interesting. This is a big collection. I mean, it's got Blu-ray and DVD copies of all three films. It's got tons of special features, commentaries, interviews. You know, I know there's some interviews between Romero and Guillermo del Toro on here. They're all like restoration from either camera negatives or the original film elements. So it's a great set if you're a Romero completist, obviously. I'm not sure if the Arrow's going to release any of these separately, maybe in the future, but I'd imagine it's probably just more, you know, more profitable to put these together, because aside from The Crazies, I can't imagine there's much call for these. I mean, Romero is kind of a director who's been pigeonholed despite everyone's respect for him.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, for those who admire Romero because of the zombie genre, I think There's Always Vanilla might be a disappointment to that crowd, considering the subject matter.
It does have Barbara from Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm with you. I think Season of the Witch is another interesting one that should be checked out as well. And we've got, from Shout Factory, we've got another Paul Naschy collection. This is the second one that they put out. I believe the first collection from Paul Naschy was put out, I want to say back maybe in June. That's just a guess without looking back. But we've got a second Paul Naschy collection coming out from Shout Factory. This set includes such films as Hunchback of the Morgue, The Devil's Possessed, The Werewolf and the Yeti, or the Yeti, for our Tony Schiavone fans out there, Exorcism, and something called The Dragonfly for each corpse. So I'm not really up on my Paul Naschy, but in terms of the titles alone, they definitely sound Mexican. It even kind of, some of the titles kind of ring kind of like they have a Giallo ring to them in terms of the titles.
Yeah, Dragonfly for each corpse. I mean, that's like a classic nonsensical giallo title. I believe that one is like his take on a giallo. You know, I haven't seen any of these. My Paul Naschy knowledge is pretty limited. I think I've only seen a couple. Werewolf Meets the Vampire Woman comes to mind. But, yeah, I mean, for these collections Scream puts out of Naschy are like 50 or 60 bucks for 5 movies. So it's a pretty decent deal if you just want, like, if you've just got, you know, a collection you've seen a million times over, and you want like a shot of something new immediately. Like, for someone curious, I think you're probably at least gonna get some enjoyment out of these.
Yeah, definitely. I think for genre fans, this is something that a completist will want to check out. Definitely from 60s and early 70s perspective on a horror. It's for collectors only, I guess, considering that Paul Naschy is, I guess, sort of an acquired taste, but from what my understanding. What about another Shout Factory release here, Joel? This is more along the lines of a kind of stuff that we want to see more of. Attack of the Puppet People.
Bird Eye Gordon.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, he's the director of stuff like Empire of the Ants, which I have a copy of. It's on a 2-movie set with Jaws of Satan. That's a delicious set, Joel. So, we also have like if you're a fan of like cult movie actors, we've got John Agar, Susan Gordon's in it, John Hoyt. Basically, we've got a doll maker who turns people into living puppets, and then he does some strange things, like making them put on parties and sing to them, and until the puppets, they get tired of it and they decide to strike back against him. So it's definitely one of those from the 50s, 60s genre of sci-fi horror. So it's definitely one to check out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Burt is a mad genius. Like, this was actually on a double bill when it was originally released with War of the Colossal Beast, which Burt also directed. If you needed someone to make something bigger or smaller on camera and you didn't really care how natural it looked, Bird Eye Gordon. Yeah. He gave us the amazing Colossal Man. He's a legend just for that. But, he turned to killer animal films later on. Foo of the Gods, Empire of the Ants. He's still out there. He's still working. He did a film like 3 years ago. He's 95 right now. I got to meet him at a con a couple of years back. We bought a copy of his autobiography and had him sign it. He's just a mad genius. I love the guy.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely a popular guy among genre film fans for sure. We've got a few releases coming out this coming week, Joel, for the week release date, November 21st. Well, let's kick off one with from AGFA, an Ed Wood film. The Violent Years from 1956.
Yeah, this is Ed Wood's classic girl gang film. So you're gonna get a lot of violence and a lot of cheesecake and heist scenes and probably some Angora sweaters. It's a 4K scan from the original 35mm. Negative. I mean, this is really great stuff they're putting together here. I believe AGFA was responsible for the Blu-ray of the Zodiac Killer that we discussed. a while back.
Yeah, the Zodiac Killer movie that was actually designed to draw out the actual Zodiac Killer.
AGFA is putting together some really interesting, really cool, weird, obscure stuff. I'm actually surprised that they managed to get this one before Vinegar Syndrome got their hands on it. But I think they're doing this in conjunction with Something Weird Video, which has been putting out, distributing movies and trailer compilations for years and years.
Yep.
This is just going to be wonderful sleazy madness like Ed Wood specializes in.
Absolutely. For you MST3K fans, looks like set number volume number 39 is set to be released this week.
Yeah, this is kind of a bittersweet one because this is likely the last release of the original round of the series. I mean, I believe they either have or are going to have a set of the new Netflix run very soon.
Yeah.
But, there's about, I think, 10 or 11 films left that they don't have the rights for and presumably won't be getting the able to get them anytime soon, obviously including the Godzilla films they did. So this is probably going to be the last set of the original MST. Includes Girls Town, The Amazing Transparent Man, Satellite Dishes, and the finale of the original series, Danger Diabolik, which I believe is a Mario Bava film based on the Italian comic book character.
Yeah, cool, okay. Yeah, I was watching because Comet TV has some MST3K episodes on Sunday nights, and they keep rerunning the same ones over and over. But I caught the one for Hobgoblins.
Yes.
Last weekend, and I'm still kind of working myself into the MST3K thing. I'm not a huge fan of the riff style of watching a movie. Because it kind of distracts from the dialogue that I actually want to hear. But, here and there I've delved in a little bit, and I actually enjoyed the one for Hobgoblins. So I might check out Volume 39 here.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one for hardcore MST fans, I think. But the great thing about the show is that, it's a jumping on point. Like any episode is conceivably a jumping on point, pretty much.
Yeah. The Criterion Collection has another release coming out this coming week. Terry Gilliam's Jabberwocky.
Yeah, that's I've never seen it, but I figured a Gilliam film would be of potential interest to. Anyone listening to our podcast, I mean, it's based on the Lewis Carroll poem. It's got Michael Palin. It's something I've been meaning to see for a long while. It's Criterion, so yeah. And of course, it's a 4K transfer from a restoration the BFI did. Terry Gilliam approved everything himself, so I'm sure this is the best possible version of the film you're going to see. Speaking of Criterion, this is a little far off in the future, but they just announced their February releases, and they include Silence of the Lambs, which they've released before, but a very long time ago,
yeah.
And something I've been waiting for them to finally do, Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, okay. The original?
Yeah, the original 68. And that's probably due to the restoration that's been making its way around... in screenings around the country lately, but so that's far off in the future. We'll remind our listeners when the week comes in February that they're coming out.
Yeah.
But Criterion's always. I mean, they're a consistent pipeline of new stuff, but it's nice to see them delving into stuff that is a little more genre oriented sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and for those of you that enjoy the selection from Criterion, I'm sure many of you already know about this, but the streaming service Filmstruck is probably something that you want to check out because there is a slew of Criterion films on Filmstruck, and so again, screw Netflix. Sign up for Filmstruck.
And Filmstruck's the reason I got rid of my Hulu, because as soon as they started that, they took all their movies off Hulu.
Absolutely, good choice. So Joel, we were mentioning we've got some more Miyazaki releases this week from G-Kids. What you got there?
Yeah, we've got Porco Rosso, which I've unfortunately never seen. I think it's probably on the set I have that Amazon put out a couple of Christmases ago, with I think all of Miyazaki's films up to that point. But I mean, it's Miyazaki. He's consistently quality, and you know, it's only like $14 on Amazon right now, so it's definitely worth looking into. This one is not a Miyazaki directed film, but it's from Studio Ghibli. This is The Secret World of Arrietty, okay. Which is I believe inspired by The Borrowers, or possibly a similar children's novel of that stuff. Yeah, it is based on The Borrowers. This is one I actually was lucky enough to see when Disney put it out in theater, when it came out, probably about 3 or 4 years ago or so. It's a really charming, lovely little film, directed by Hiromasa Yonebayashi, if I'm saying that anywhere near correct. It is a Studio Ghibli release. These are both from G-Kids, who have had the license to do, I think, most if not all of the Studio Ghibli stuff lately, and have been putting them out at a pretty rapid clip, probably in preparation for Christmas.
Yeah, everything's in preparation for Christmas, Joel. Yeah, so yeah, there'll be some happy Miyazaki fans this Christmas, I'm sure. We've got a few collections out there from Miyazaki that have been put out lately. Anyway, we want to talk about another collection here, and this one more for the rabid cinephile in your life. It's a Fritz Lang complete collection of Fritz Lang films. So tell us more about that one, Joel.
Yeah, this is a really wonderful set. It's from Kino Classics, who we tend to spotlight a lot because they're at this point practically rivaling Criterion with the quality and the quality of their releases, both in terms of film choice and the actual quality of the packages they put together. And this is a pretty momentous one. I mean, this is Fritz Lang's entire silent filmography. Everything he did from, I think, something like 1919 to 1929, including Metropolis, which is probably the big draw for most people who are interested in Fritz Lang, but might not know a lot of his other silent films. I mean, some of his later films have a significant following and reputation, stuff like M, The Big Heat. I mean, he worked for decades and decades. But his early silent films, when he was still working in Germany and Austria, aside from Metropolis, probably have much less accessibility for people. So this is really nice to see that people have the ability to see all of these movies. It's a pretty exceptional set. I mean, a few of his early films are actually lost films, because it's the silent era and that's just what happens. But there's some exceptional stuff here. I mean, his Dr. Mabuse films are in this. A Woman in the Moon, Spies. His film of the Ring Cycle, two films based on that. It just really phenomenal stuff. I mean, obviously, this is you're probably not gonna just buy this out of curiosity because it's a bit expensive. I mean, it's MSRP of $150. So it's $94 on Amazon if you feel like treating yourself. But you know, if you're a dedicated film junkie, this is like this is a pretty momentous set.
Absolutely, it sure is. And it's always amazing when you know a collection like this comes out because you know in this era, you know, the silent film era isn't really everyone's cup of tea, and a lot of these movies are not very accessible or easy to find, I guess I should say.
And well, so, even yeah, the, when even like TCM doesn't play silent stuff that often unless it's like incredibly famous or really crowd pleasing, like Chaplin comedies or something.
Yeah, this is the silent era. You know, isn't acquired taste. It's not for everyone, but it's also cinematic history. And if you're a film buff, then you know the silent era is where you know everyone really needs to start and jump in, because there is a just because there's no talking doesn't make it not a good movie. And there's a lot of exceptional standout films from that era that really need to be seen before you die, and a collection like this is probably you know very important to keep that era alive in the minds of a lot of people. So,
well, especially because in the current era, like we're in an era where we just don't have the because of our reliance on streaming, we're sort of slowly giving up control of our cinematic history to people curating it for us. And, you know, obviously, like, you know, we joke about your anti-Netflix crusade, but, you know, I'm with you on that because the whole deal is that Netflix is basically a content producer now, rather than just a curator, and that means that like the biggest streaming service has no interest in history. Right. So much of Netflix's archives, in terms of their streaming properties, are mostly recent stuff, like just absolutely crammed with stuff they could get at the cheapest possible licensing fees, just to you know preserve the illusion of choice.
Exactly.
You don't have choice. You have Stranger Things.
See, you put it much more eloquently than I ever could. I'm just like, Netflix sucks. I've summed it up in two words, and Joel, I can always rely on you to go much deeper in thought, man. That's why you're on the show.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we need two words to shut me up.
Yeah, I told you, man, I'm riding your coattails on this thing. So, so all right. So there's your new releases for the last couple of weeks. Some very interesting ones in there, so be sure and check them out and enjoy. Although we've got other pressing business, we've got some movies to discuss, and so we wanted to change the pace up a little bit and talk about some fun movies. And the first one we want to talk about on this show is actually a cult favorite and is one of my personal favorites. It's the 1980 science fiction action film Flash Gordon, based on the comic strip of the same name, which was created by Alex Raymond. Flash Gordon, directed by Mike Hodges. Mike Hodges has, some known films under his belt at this point. He did Damien, Omen 2. I actually wrote the screenplay for that in 1977. He didn't direct it, but The Terminal Man from 1974 with George Segal. I actually have a copy of that on VHS, Joel, The Terminal Man. And very unique film for the early 70s, man's interaction with computers and whatnot. Later on, after Flash Gordon, Mike Hodges would direct a few other things, like the Mickey Rourke film A Prayer for the Dying. He also did some television here and there, nothing really noteworthy. So I think Flash Gordon probably stands out as Mike Hodges' personal pièce de résistance.
Well, not to take away from Flash, but I'd say my favorite Hodges film is still, I think his first probably. It's a favorite of mine, Michael Caine in Get Carter.
Oh, Get Carter, yeah, that is a good film.
But I mean, obviously, that just mentioning those two gives you an idea of. Hodges did return to crime films a lot. I mean, his most recent film, which was like 15 years ago now, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, which is another British gangster film with Clive Owen.
Yeah.
So he did a lot of British crime films, but I mean, the fact that he went from Get Carter to The Terminal Man and Flash Gordon, it's a pretty remarkable range.
Yeah, and so it's quite interesting, you know, when you see the finished product that Flash Gordon was, you know, it's really, if you did not know Mike Hodges directed that would totally take you by surprise
if you
found out later.
Get Carter is so controlled and so gritty and tight, and there's such a sheen of dirt and sleaze on it. It's, and then Flash is just big and bombastic and psychedelic. I mean, it's just... The fact that that Hodges has such a, and the fact that Hodges has the mastery of tone to commit to such different styles, to make those work. And Flash Gordon, as we'll get into in just a bit, is pure camp, but it works, and it works. For all you can say about it, it works. It has such personality, like. It's really a remarkable, like, strange explosion of a movie.
And of course, you know, the producer behind the whole thing, of course, is Dino De Laurentiis, who
because when you need a big film to look as cheap as possible, you get Dino.
That's right. You know, behind so many huge productions in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, Dino De Laurentiis was never one to really think small.
No.
Yeah, and definitely the case here. We'll run down the cast real quick. Of course, we'll start at the top with Sam J. Jones himself. You know, he was nominated for a Razzie for this movie, a Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Actor.
Well, which is both fair and not totally fair, because one of the probably more famous bits of trivia about this film is that they overdubbed all of his performance.
Oh, yeah, because he walked out at, on post-production, and so he wasn't around, and so they overdubbed his voice in quite a few scenes with someone else.
So for the most part, we're not getting his performance. I'm not, like, the dissonance is immediately obvious from his first line, but yeah, I'm not sure if he would have been much better. But luckily, he doesn't need to do the heavy lifting. He just needs to do physical stuff, and he's at least a very, like, energetic physical presence.
Yeah, I was fine with Sam Jones for this kind of movie. His performance, I think, was spot on for, you know, what this movie ended up being. I want to note one thing about Sam Jones. In watching the movie Ted, Sam Jones's cameo in Ted was probably the funniest thing in that movie. The dream sequence of Flash Gordon with Mark Wahlberg on the sky speeder, or whatever you want to call it. Quite funny. Melody Anderson as the female lead in this film is Dale Arden. Of course, Melody kind of breaking into the scene at this point in time. I mean, just before this, she was in the Elvis TV movie. I think that was the John Carpenter TV movie with Kurt Russell, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right.
She was in Dead and Buried, following Flash Gordon. Dead and Buried. She appeared in the TV series Manimal.
Manimal!
Yes. Definitely. I agree with that enthusiasm about Manimal.
And she still managed to keep working after Manimal, so God bless her.
Oh, well, yeah, but, I mean, she worked in Firewalker with Chuck Norris and Lou Gossett Jr. And I think a little bit further down the line in the 90s, I think she broke down into, like, made-for-TV fare and soap operas. And so Melody Anderson was kind of her star was on the rise at this point, but I think she didn't reach the heights that maybe she probably should have. I think her performance here in Flash Gordon was adequate, suitable. She was there was a lot of comedy in her dialogue, and as well as her physical performance, and it was solid. You know, a little good early performance there for Melody Anderson.
You know, there's part of me that almost feels like so many things about this movie were almost designed to be the opposite of Star Wars, which is obviously the shadow being cast over this, even though Flash Gordon had been around for a long time, and George Lucas had tried to option Flash Gordon to make a Flash Gordon movie.
And and that's right, and the story was he couldn't, so he went ahead and made Star Wars instead.
Yeah, because at the time, weirdly enough, the option to... of course, De Laurentiis had the... originally had the rights, but the option was taken at the time by Fellini, of all people.
Yeah. That was one thing I wanted to bring up about this movie, is that De Laurentiis originally had lined up Federico Fellini to direct this thing.
And there were a few other directors who were potentially attached. Sergio Leone was named. Nicholas Roeg, director of Walkabout and Don't Look Now. I mean, some really amazing talent. I would have loved to see what any of them would have done with this. And I mean, there were a lot of both missed opportunities and things that went right here. I mean, one of the original choice for Flash, and I wish he hadn't have turned it down, it was Kurt Russell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's kind of like, and this is just before him taking on the Snake Plissken role in Escape from New York. So, it would have been interesting to see him jump from what he did Elvis just before this, so from Elvis to Flash Gordon.
I think we would have gotten a much more mischievous, maybe even snarky Flash, along the lines of Jack Burton.
Yeah, it suddenly jumped into my head, you know, considering how Sam Jones performed the role. I could see Kurt Russell taking that and turning it into, like, a pre-Jack Burton type, you know, smart-ass role.
That feels like the way he would have gone, which actually might have backfired, because, I mean, it's essentially, if you're trying to get away from Star Wars and your main character is just like Han Solo, then you're going to invite comparison.
I think Kurt Russell probably would have brought a lot of self-awareness, which probably would have taken away from it. Sam Jones is actually not too self-aware in this movie. Well,
I feel like the great thing is that as campy as everyone is, they seem committed. Like, there's not... Like, there's a lot of disregarding self-awareness here from actors who you know are aware.
Yeah, I guess that's a better way to put that.
But I mean, no, Sam was totally unself-aware.
He's totally clueless. He didn't know what he was doing out there. What about, we've got the Fiddler on the Roof himself in here, Topol.
He was awesome.
Yeah, as Dr. Zarkov, yeah.
Who I believe is one of the characters from the actual comic. I'm not sure. I think most of these are actually characters from the comic strip, because I remember reading that Brian Blessed, when he was, and we'll get to him in a bit, wanted to play, would play Flash Gordon as a kid and would be Prince Voltan, which is an amazing story. But yeah, Topol, the Fiddler on the Roof himself, gives like an amazingly like wild, spirited performance. It's just, he's just insane. Like, he comes on, and he, like, and that's another thing, like, the scientific mentor figure, he's not, like, some dignified Obi-Wan, he's, like, a wild-eyed scientist of the, they didn't believe me, but I was right all along, like, you know, mode. Like, he's just fantastic, holding people at gunpoint to be part of his like launch into space to save the world. There's no like, you know, after the sort of...
I mean, he has this line in the beginning of the movie when the Earth is under attack by Ming and stuff's falling from the sky, and he sees the moon being pulled towards Earth, and he pronounces he wakes up from a nap or something, and he demands his assistant check the angle of the moon, and he's pointing to the sky, and it's just very over the top and melodramatic, and it was totally appropriate for this movie.
And the best part is, like, that's the moment where you know what you're getting into, because yeah, everything till then has been, if not subdued, at least like kind of grounded. Like, we, you know, we sit, there's crazy weather stuff going on, but like, and Flash is on, that... Flash and Dale are on an airplane that like is crashing, so things are getting weird, but you don't realize the scope of how weird this movie's going to be until you see the science guy, like, doing science in the most insane way possible.
Well, yeah, I mean, you backtrack a little bit. You know what you're getting into when you see Ming the Merciless at his control board, and he's got buttons labeled earthquake and volcanic eruption and hot hail.
I mean, that was insane, but that's almost like a level of pulp insanity that you could kind of, like, if you know going in that you're like going to a movie based on a pulpy comic strip, so that's sort of like within the realm of possibility. Like, oh yeah, there's the earthquake, but I mean, we're not in 1980. Like, there have probably been Bond villains before that had an earthquake button. Like, for an audience in 1980, that's not too too crazy, but waving around a gun to get people on your spaceship is the kind of crazy that this,
you trick them by saying, yeah, the telephone's right there in my rocket, go ahead, step inside. But yeah, about Ming, Max von, see, I don't know if it's Sydow, Sydow.
I've always said Sydow.
Yeah, Max von Sydow, and of course as Ming, and I think he, I actually think he underplays it just a little bit. I mean, I think Ming should be this over-the-top, you know, cartoonish villain, and not to say he is, he certainly looks like it, he looks the part. I actually think this is like an understated performance from Von Sydow, and it's kind of worked. He was kind of like playing the straight man to everyone else's campiness, really.
You know, I wanted to bring that up because it is an interestingly underplayed performance to me. Like, when you see him, like, you expect like a lot of scene chewing, and he's very controlled, not in a boring way. Like, you know, he's obviously like relishing all these awful things he does, but he's not doing it in a way that's he doesn't seem like he's got a hair trigger temper.
Right.
But that, like, a lot of megalomaniacal villains do. He seems very controlled. I find that interesting because, you know, there's some pretty open comparisons between him and Hitler, and we'll probably get into that a bit more. And I feel like it was very purposeful to give you a villain that, like, you know, is almost... I don't know how people viewed, like, Hitler's temperament in 1980 as compared to like how we do now, has a very sort of pathetically temperamental type. Okay. But yeah, no, he's the evil villain he's a card carrying villain. He loves being evil overlord. He calls himself Ming the Merciless. He like has a persona that he lives up to every day, and it seems effortless. But yeah, he's not someone who seems irritated by setbacks. He's not someone above negotiating. He's an intelligent villain. It's actually it's interesting in the middle of this insanity that he's such a brilliant sort of chess master and political figure.
Yeah. Probably the one scene I enjoyed most with Ming in it was during the scene where Clytus was torturing his daughter because he found out that she freed Flash Gordon. And what's her name? Aura. Yeah. And so they're whipping her, and she keeps yelling out that, you know, Clytus is going to pay once her father finds out what he's doing. And Clytus says, well, let's ask him. And, of course, the door opens, and there's Ming standing there eating popcorn, watching his daughter get flogged. And Clytus is like, well, sir, shall I stop the torture? And he takes a bite of popcorn or whatever he's eating and goes, no.
And yeah, that's kind of like perfect under-overacting almost. Like, he's over the top in a way that you don't expect. He's not raging. He's just enjoying being evil.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think by understating his performance, I really think Von Sydow stands out in terms of the game. Of course, he's probably, you know, with a couple of exceptions, he's probably the strongest actor on the cast, no question. There's a couple of others, like one other guy we're going to talk about, Timothy Dalton. I've always enjoyed Timothy Dalton. Here is Prince Baron. You know, kind of, at first he's a rival with Flash Gordon, mainly because Aura, Prince Baron's, I guess, girlfriend or lover, he's a little jealous. There's a little bit of a jealous rivalry going on, and then eventually Flash Gordon, you know, shows that, you know, he's a stand-up guy and he wants to side with Baron, and they become friends. And so I thought this was a pretty good, you know, action movie performance by Dalton. You know, a little kind of a precursor to his stint in the couple of James Bond movies that he did. So I thought, and Dalton actually played it straight throughout the film. He didn't really have much campy dialogue or anything like that. You know, he was pretty much one of the more straighter characters in the film, and I think Dalton did pretty good with it.
Oh yeah, I think he's I think he's very good. Like apparently he his performance was inspired by advice he got from Von Sydow about not overplaying, which makes sense because he's the guy who's the rightful heir to this the throne of this world. Like, you want to believe in him has a respectable leader, and he, you know, he's manages to always be surprising even when he's underplaying it. Like, I mean, we see him take part in these initiation rituals to his world where he has to mercy kill someone. We see him betray Flash, then fight Flash, then, you know, join Flash's side. Like, I mean, which is not totally a surprise because, you know, face turns by rivals are common in, like, pulp adventure, but,
yeah,
he plays things so close to the vest in an interesting way that, like, and because it's always clear that he's always got motivations and, you know, idea, like, his own motivations and ideas about what's going on around him, rather than just he's there to be Flash's sidekick or whatever. So, like, you get the sense of someone who's an independent actor in his own right, like, pursuing his own goals, and it makes him, like, both a source of tension and a source of surprise in the film, because you're not really sure how it's going to end up with him.
Yeah. So, and it was definitely a solid performance from Dalton there. But let's talk about a guy that we mentioned just a few minutes ago, Joel, Brian Blessed, as Prince Voltan.
This is probably the iconic performance in the movie, because Brian Blessed is Brian Blessed. And Brian Blessed, I mean, yeah, we could joke all day about his, like, loud voice and his big burly stature and his beard, and just he has the voice of someone who's meant to have a beard. The amazing thing about him, aside from, like, the energy and boisterousness and larger life quality he has, is that when you put Brian Blessed in a scenario where there's a battle sequence, it makes you feel like you're going to war alongside someone.
Oh yeah, just that whole gung ho attitude throughout the movie, and of course he got the the all-time meme with the line, "Gordon's alive?"
He's got such a wonderful big butt, like, and personality-filled voice, and like every line of his is an instant classic.
Yeah, and yeah, it was definitely he was I guess more of the comedic role in this. I mean, we've got Sam Jones as Flash Gordon, but that's unintentional comedy. But you know, we've got Brian Blessed gets probably all the funnier moments in the film, and when they're attacking the when they're attacking the ship near the end, and Voltan is all just growling at everything as he's diving into attack. It's just, yeah, like you said, it just felt like you know, you're right there alongside him, just ready to jump in and, you know, kick someone's ass.
Yeah, his energy is so infectious. I mean, it's just impossible not to be, like, spurred on by him.
Yeah. One thing to mention is about the screenplay written or co-written by Michael Allen, who wrote Enter the Dragon for the screen, and Lorenzo Semple Jr., who some people may be familiar with as the guy who scripted the King Kong remake from 1976. So Lorenzo Semple Jr. is definitely no stranger to campy films and campy dialogue.
Oh, yeah, and let's not forget, he's also done some very down-to-earth serious stuff. He did The Parallax View. He did the Super Cops, The Drowning Pool, one of my favorite espionage thrillers, 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah.
And I believe he did Never Say Never Again, if I remember right. And speaking of campiness, he's also the screenwriter on the 1966 Batman film.
Yeah, he did write some episodes of the Adam West Batman series. So yeah, I mean, and Flash Gordon, actually, the tone is actually a lot similar to the 60s Batman series. So, I mean, I think Semple's screenplay has a lot to do with that as well. I mean, that's the connecting link between the two.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that campiness, that over-the-top humor, those larger-life personalities, he has long experience writing in that style. And, you know, if you were going to make an over-the-top, like, superhero thing, like, that was the perfect choice.
And of course, the soundtrack and the score performed and written by Freddie Mercury and Queen. I mean, this is one of the things that a lot of people remember about Flash Gordon is the soundtrack, especially the title theme that we all know and love. And there's definitely the whole you remember the for Ming and Dale's wedding ceremony, they had like a rock version of Here Comes the Bride.
Yes.
Yeah, Voltan and Flash are on the ship trying to get to the palace, and Voltan's like, "Let's see what's on the radio," and he's fiddling with the knob, and there here comes the Here Comes the Bride rock theme as done by Queen.
And I should also mention that, in addition to Queen, the score was also composed by Howard Blake.
Yeah, Howard Blake.
Who he's done a lot of classical compositions, but in terms of movies, he's probably best known for this, as well as the BBC's film of the Snowman, the animated film.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So I know the. That's probably a cult classic for some of our listeners, and the song "Walking in the Air" has been from that soundtrack has been covered so many times. So it's a Christmas classic.
Yeah.
So we're talking about someone with a really wonderful career, and of course Queen. I mean, for sheer bombast, I don't think there's ever been a rock band to come close to Queen.
Right, yeah, definitely. Definitely, you know, the glam rock era of the 70s, Queen was in the midst of that. But they did carry a lot of that over into the 80s, you know, long after glam rock had been phased out. And, you know, Freddie Mercury was always one to be larger than life in a lot of, you know, a lot of things. And Queen is one of those bands that, you know, they stand out because of the fact that they're big and huge and loud, and it's just one.
And, you know, Queen's an interesting case because, I mean, of course they're big and huge, but they're also very their music can often be very complicated, very structurally layered, or you know, compositionally layered. You know, they resolve a lot of different influences together. A lot, I mean, you know, rock influences, jazz influences, classical. There's a lot of different modes going on in their music. And also, like, in terms of bands that have sort of a place in time, Queen is an interesting case, and they're almost uniquely perfect for a Flash Gordon film, which is a very retro view of the future, because Queen does a lot of futuristic stuff and a lot of, like, sort of retro stuff. I mean, you know, a lot of their work is inspired by the tone and, like, feel of opera, of course. I mean, obviously, stuff like Bohemian Rhapsody. But, you know, they're interested in the Victorian era. At the same time, they're interested in the future. You know, there's that famous, we mentioned Fritz Lang's Metropolis earlier. There's that famous 80s
Radio Gaga. The video for Radio Gaga looked like incorporated Metropolis.
Yeah, I believe they did a Metropolis in the 80s, or released one that had, I'm not sure if this was a legitimate release or something someone cut together that had a fully Queen soundtrack to it.
Yeah.
Like, Queen's sort of uniquely suited for this sort of retro future vibe, which is really fascinating that, like, those two things, like, you know, this movie and that band came around the same time to, like, fit together so perfectly. It's such a strange, like, moment in time.
Yeah, and then when we talk about Flash Gordon becoming, like, it has a huge, you know, cult following. You know, some of the more notable people that are fans of this movie, I mean, director Edgar Wright's gone on record as saying that he loves this movie. He actually used it as an inspiration for the visual look of the movie Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And comic book artist Alex Ross, he says this is one of his favorite films of all time, and he actually painted the cover of the 2007 re-release of Flash Gordon, the Savior of the Universe edition. So, and of course we talked about Ted earlier, where Seth MacFarlane actually incorporated Sam Jones in a cameo, which was quite hilarious. Sam Jones also appears in the sequel Ted 2. So a lot of influence there from this movie. Of course, Brian Blessed actually that one line, "Gordon's alive," actually, you know, it's the people, you know, it's been repeated and reused and recycled across the internet, and people will always remember Brian Blessed from Flash Gordon. I mean, he did much more than that, but this was his magnum opus, so to speak.
If I recall, even the Queen asked him to say that line too.
He can't escape it, but you know, he seems like the kind of guy that, you know, really doesn't mind doing something like that for the Queen. I mean, in talking about Flash Gordon, you know, you can it has a cult following for sure, but you know. And the movie, you know, in terms of, you know, if I was to review this film, basically, it's just a fun, silly sci-fi, you know, adventure story that has its roots steeped in comics or comic strips where it came from. And everything about it is loud and big and boisterous, and it doesn't let up for an instant. And it's just sheer entertainment. It is not... I was going to say it's not art, but there is some artistry in this in terms of the production design and the costumes and whatnot. So yeah, but in terms of the bigger picture, it's more of an escapist entertainment than a great movie. Some people may take exception to it, but I call those people snobs. And if you're a snob, this movie's not for you. You know, Flash Gordon is one of my personal favorite films, and I strongly recommend Flash Gordon for anyone who just wants to sit in the chair and be brain dead for 2 hours.
Yeah. Now, you know, Flash, it's a film with a ton of personality. It's so engaging. I mean, you know, there's so much we could probably say about the visual style. It's almost like the next step in the... It's not so much Star Wars, and of course I've been bringing that up a lot, but obviously Flash Gordon came out because Star Wars became the biggest film of all time. But it's more like the weird psychedelic 60s sci-fi films like Danger Diabolic that I mentioned earlier with MST and like Barbarella. Yeah. Things like that. Like those influences are sort of writ large on this. I mean, before Queen signed on, I know Mike Hodges was considering asking Pink Floyd to do the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Wow, yeah.
Which I think would have been a mistake. You would have gotten a very sort of surreal experience without any lightening of the tone.
Right.
Like Pink Floyd is not really fun. I don't really like them in general, but they're not really like an adventure band like Queen.
Exactly.
Like Queen is.
Yeah, Queen was much more suited to this material.
Yeah.
And I actually think, you know, Hodges and De Laurentiis, they actually set out to make Flash Gordon into what we see as the final product. I mean, they just wanted to have fun with it, and that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, I mean, it really was, I think, in its own weird way, sort of an antidote to Star Wars and, you know, the increasing sort of pompousness of... I mean, there's a lot of, like, very serious sci-fi in the 70s, a lot of which I love, like Logan's Run, but... and Soylent Green, but there, it's easy to view that stuff as too self-serious, too pompous, and even Star Wars, like, there's no sort of overarching mythology here. There's no, like attempts at, like, deep spirituality.
Yeah.
It's just, it flashes, it's... When you're seeing Flash, like, throw, like, metal medicine ball kind of things at dudes, like... Well, Dale does a cheerleading routine to like it's yeah. bolster him on in yeah. the throne room.
Well, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, man.
Oh, it's just phenomenal. It's just it's batshit. Like the film is insane. It's really fun. I mean, it's the kind of film like you've got to leave your preconceptions about like what makes a good sci-fi film at the door. Like, the only film around this era I think it's at all close to is probably Hawk the Slayer.
Hawk the Slayer, yeah. We're probably going to have to talk about Hawk the Slayer one day.
We will. Like, I mean, Hawk obviously did not have the budget this film does, even though the special effects in this film are quite dodgy sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, they both had that sort of cheery audacity to them. Like, they're just, like, gonna take the ideas they have and just run with it and see like what weird avenues they find with it. You know, there's no control here, which is weird because all these like disparate tones actually end up working together very well. And I don't know how that happened because like if you had a film with all these competing tones from its cast and from its like soundtrack and story and all that, like if you had that now, it's like Suicide Squad. Like it just fundamentally doesn't work. And I don't know if that's just because it wasn't really re-edited in post to be something else. They had an idea of what they wanted to do, and everyone in their own way found a way to contribute towards that goal.
Yeah, exactly. And I think everyone, you know, this pretty much was everyone turning it up to 11, except for Sam Jones. He held steady at 8, and I want to mention you talk about Star Wars real quick. I want to mention there's a couple of connecting points in terms of casting that Flash Gordon has with Star Wars. Number one, Dr. Zarkov's assistant in the beginning of the film, Munson, was played by William Hootkins, Porkins, from the original Star Wars X-Wing
Porkins
pilot.
Himself.
Yeah, he was in this, and there was a, apparently there was a several dwarves in the film. One of the dwarves was played by Kenny Baker, R2-D2. So you know, we got a couple of Star Wars cast members here in Flash Gordon.
And speaking of our dwarf actors in this, we should mention one who also appeared in the Star Wars films. One of the more famous dwarf actors out there, Deep Roy, is Princess Aura's sort of pet dwarf in this. Who,
oh yeah, it was named Fellini.
Fellini. So we've got some real like little people talent here. I don't know. I don't actually know what the current sensitive term to call dwarves is. I think they just kind of stuck with dwarves.
Yeah, I think they prefer little people.
Is little people now the one they're comfortable with?
I'm not trying to be sarcastic or condescending. I'm not up on my PC terminology that much, Joel, knowing me. So
see, I usually am.
But
I went to a liberal arts college. I'm up on this shit.
Don't use we're not like Vince McMahon in the 80s here, so we're not to use the term midget anymore.
Oh, Vince.
Yeah.
Oh, Vince.
Yeah. So what do you think, Joel? It sounds like you're giving Flash Gordon some high praise here.
You know, I gotta say, watching it this week, I'm gonna have to make a confession. This was my first time seeing Flash Gordon.
Oh wow! Yeah.
I know. I just, you know, I think it was years of sort of being turned off by Star Wars that sort of kept me away. But yeah, I'm a bit softer on Star Wars now that I really enjoyed Force Awakens for the most part. So I'm a bit softer on like these kind of sci-fi adventures, but I really should have given this a chance earlier because it's very much its own thing. Very distinctly its own thing. I mean, I love the 60s Batman series growing up. I probably would have loved this too if I had known what this was doing. Also, the inherent strangeness of the thing, I think, kind of turned me off because, like, I had seen the way it looks and I just had nothing, like, no way to process it. I should say that something I did get a chance to bring up is that there's a lot of very obvious sort of playoffs on Nazi imagery with Ming. And of course, we mentioned the Hitler stuff. I mean, his throne room is like pure Riefenstahl. It's like total triumph of the will. And so it's a very, like, just that they're sort of having a laugh about how stupid Nazi imagery is, how stupid fascist imagery is. I mean, you know, there's so many ideas in this film. There's so many, like, and they're all sort of tossed off very casually. I mean, it's not like a film about ideas, just you can see it in the visuals. Like the stuff they're playing around with, and there's so many weird, fascinating moments. There's a lot of great lines and great, like, you know, very unique performances. So I mean, of course, I recommend it. I think you'd have a lot of people might be resistant to it in the way I was, or even while watching it, they might be resistant to it because it's just not the film you're expecting. If you're expecting like a more traditional adventure film or a more traditional sci-fi action film, you're going to be confused and disoriented.
Yeah, it gets increasingly batshit crazy. I mean, you gotta sit through the first, you know, 20 minutes or so, but it increasingly just loses its mind, and just everything is just off the wall, throwing everything at the wall by the end. Another particularly good scene that I like, when Flash Gordon is in the at the end, he's in the burning ship, it's all in flames, and he's approaching the palace to try and stop the wedding in time, and he's approaching the palace very slowly while the Flash theme from Queen plays, and by the time he smashes into the throne room, you know, that was when they let the shields down, they could finally see the ship about to crash into the palace. I mean, that was always been a mark out moment for me. It was like, yay, he's finally there.
There's a lot of like awesomely fist pumping moments in this. Of course, I should say, not only is that the result of the soundtrack very heavily, but the soundtrack is one of the score and the Queen songs hold this film together tonally so well.
Yes, absolutely they do. I agree with that.
And it's a film that creates its tone by having like a lack of consistent tone, but it works because it's just sort of a film where anything goes.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess our Flash Gordon discussion is done. We both enjoyed it very much. A great campy action sci-fi adventure with a rousing finale as Flash himself gives a gives a leaping high five near the end.
Which, let's give Sam Jones some credit. He improvised that moment.
Yeah, you could tell.
He does a leaping high five to what seems to be a talking version of the Phantasm Ball.
Yeah, it comes out of whatever dark corner was hiding in and says, all hail Flash, and he's like, yeah! High five. Freeze frame. It was awesome. So is this movie. So, Flash Gordon, two rousing recommendations. Check it out. Don't be afraid. Check it out if you haven't seen it, man. It's a fun movie. And we enjoyed it immensely. So with that said, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, we've got another good one. We're going to talk about 1984's The Last Starfighter. So stay with us, and we'll be back.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse. the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaceVation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceVation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Box episode number 28 on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. First half of the show, we talked about our love for the movie Flash Gordon. This half of the show, we're going to stick with the 80s and another movie from the sci-fi realm. Probably not as fun as Flash Gordon, because nothing as fun as Flash Gordon, but. We're going to talk about The Last Starfighter, directed by Nick Castle. Joel, Nick Castle. He worked quite a bit with John Carpenter, screenwriter. He actually played Michael Myers in the first Halloween movie.
Michael Myers himself directed The Last Starfighter.
That's right. And he was also the co-writer of Escape from New York with Carpenter, so we've got some connections here in Nick Castle's early career.
Castle's a really interesting figure. I'm going to talk a bit about the about this in a little while later, but as you watch The Last Starfighter, obviously it's easy to place this in that sort of 80s blockbuster style that Spielberg and Lucas developed, and he's one of the writers of Spielberg's Hook later on. It's weird. He pretty much devoted himself to family-friendly stuff in terms of his career. You know, did a lot of comedies and kids movies. He directed Dennis the Menace, the live-action version of that. You know, comedies like Major Payne and Mr. Wrong.
Oh yeah, he also did The Boy Who Could Fly with the Jay Underwood movie from '86. One that I remember watching as a kid. That was more family friendly fare as well. And you mentioned Hook, and he also as recently as 2007 he wrote the screenplay for the film August Rush.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And so,
he did the screenplay for one of my favorite unreleased film, or sort of unreleased to video films, Skate Town USA, which I believe was Patrick Swayze's first film. I got to see this in a theater a few years back, and it still has not received a video release, partly because there's a lot of expensive music rights. But if you ever find a screening of that, I do not hesitate to recommend it because it's amazing. He also sort of a weird project that has always interested me. A TV movie that was sort of the burned off pilot for a series in 1990, Shangri-La Plaza, which was going to be a musical series set in a mall in Southern California. a weird project. Had a lot of interesting people involved, including Terrence Mann, who our listeners will probably know as the bounty hunter Ugg from the Critters films, but is probably most famous for being sort of Broadway royalty. I mean, the original Javert and Les Mis, the original Rum Tum Tugger and Cax. I mean, just a legendary performer. Had a lot of interesting people involved that. But I mean, we're getting a little off track, but. So Nick Castle has a weird career, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, this part of his career, 1984 at this point, he's worked, like we mentioned, a lot with John Carpenter's. He's gotten a lot of connections here at this point, and Last Starfighter's his film. Michael Myers himself is directing this thing, and the premise. You got a young guy, teenager named Alex Rogan, as played by Lance Guest. Lance Guest, who was probably one of the more unheralded teen actors of the '80s. He was. He had an appearance in Halloween 2. He actually played the grown-up Michael Brody in Jaws: The Revenge. Just probably his. Along with The Last Starfighter, Jaws the Revenge is probably his best-known work.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty notable and probably what, sidetracked his career. He's worked steadily, but, never at the level he looked like he was going to be at. Like, he looked like he was going to be, like, a pretty pretty ever-present everyman lead actor in that sort of John Cusack, Matthew Broderick mold.
And it's funny you talk about Jaws the Revenge. One might think that Jaws the Revenge sunk his big screen career, but Mario Van Peebles went on and made good for himself.
Mario Van Peebles is a Renaissance man. Is the thing. Not everyone is Mario Van Peebles. Well, you're also talking about someone. With Mario, someone from a family of independent filmmakers. Like, Mario can do his own thing, and people forget. Also, here's the part of Jaws: The Revenge that people like best. Like, people will always forgive you if you were the entertaining part in the movie that sucked.
Yeah, so Lance gets the shaft. But here in The Last Starfighter, he just plays, you know, an average kid. He's living in a trailer park with his mom and his younger brother. I believe his mom is manager of the trailer park, and he's like the everyman, the maintenance man, the guy that people call when they need something fixed with their trailer. Anyway, he gets wrapped up in playing this arcade game called Starfighter, and you know, passing the time with that because there's really not much else to do in, you know, the middle of you know, buttfuck Arizona or whatever the fuck there is.
Did they ever say where they're located?
It was the desert, man. So it was either, you know, it was either miles away from anything in Nevada or Arizona. Could have been one of the two.
I kind of figured it was like in more a drier part of California because they mentioned going to lakes. So I was wondering if maybe like they were just, it was enough in the desert where it was awful, but close enough to where they could drive to a water source.
Yeah. The trailer park was called the Starlight Starbright. I'd be honest with you, you know, I can't relate to Alex Rogan's video game skills because I sucked at video games myself. And it didn't matter if it was arcade, it was Nintendo, it was Sega Genesis. I'm not a games master, Joel. I sucked at everything I played. I never mastered any single one game. I was just horrible. So, I'm envious of Alex Rogan.
I can relate to this as someone who whittled away his time as a kid playing Galaga. So I can absolutely relate to this. what we're talking about with Alex, with this very like sort of, you know, sort of crap sack, but also sort of romanticized trailer park, the kind of place where, you know, it's sort of charmingly in disrepair. Like, this is the very, like, 80s blockbuster style. Like, the situation the main character comes from is dilapidated enough for us to really feel sympathetic, but at the same time, like, it's not depressing. Like, there's a real sense of community here that, in my experience with real-life trailer parks, is not quite as present. Like, you know, this is a place where he's got a wise old black handyman to learn from, like, where, like, he's about to beat the record on Starfighter, and the whole trailer park comes in.
Yes, that's one thing I wanted to touch on, was that the whole ridiculousness of that situation of, like, someone noticing that he's approaching the high score, and Otis, the black guy you referred to, is yelling, "Hey, everybody, Alex is getting the high score!" And here comes everyone coming down and yelling and screaming and hollering, and this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to them.
You really think they would have saved that for him presumably getting into, like, a really good college, because that becomes a plot point where he can't get a loan for it. Now, Otis, by the way, for our horror fans, is Vernon Washington, George, the grandfather of the young Reggie in Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Which just a year after this. The 80s blockbuster style where films at this point were being made for kids from single-parent families. I mean, literally, there's demographic data about this, and it sort of tipped over in the 90s again, in the late 90s again, when Disney's adventure films for single child families, especially for boys, fell apart with the collapse of, like, Treasure Planet, Atlantis, all those films they were trying at the time that bombed. Yep. Like, films at this time were being made initially, I probably by accident, but now very purposely for single child homes or single parent homes. So there's a lot of that here. I mean, he's got a younger brother, but they're very far apart in age. Like, we see his dad in that picture, but I don't know if they're divorced or if the dad died or what.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the mom's a waitress. Obviously, they, like, you know, live in a trailer park. Like I said, it's depressing, but not so, because it's so purposely colorful and
mildly comedic. Yeah,
it's gently comedic and it's close knit. It's very folksy, like, you know, it's absolute Hollywood.
Yeah, you've got a character that everyone calls Granny.
You've got his, like, you know, presumably childhood sweetheart living, like, right next trailer over to from him, and Catherine Mary Stewart. And I'm sorry, I have trailer parks where I'm from. I've been to trailer parks. I've never seen a girl look like Catherine Mary Stewart.
Now, Catherine Mary Stewart did not look like she belonged in a trailer park. She looked, there's just a natural classiness to her look that seems like she's above all that.
Now you'd expect, like, a tomboyish love interest, like a very sort of, maybe like a very spunky, and not that Catherine isn't, but she's a very, like, she's got a sort of dramatic, glamorous beauty to her. Like, you know, she's kind of like, almost like Jessica Harper in that respect.
Yeah.
You'd expect, like, a Christy McNichol type, like a very, like, you know, spunky tomboyish
person. Oh, yes. And if The Last Starfighter was made in the 90s, we could have put Lori Petty in that role, you know?
Yeah. Oh, my God. She would have been there immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Alex is breaking the high score in this Starfighter arcade game, and everyone's there watching, and he finally does it. And a little while later, we have Centauri make an appearance, played by Robert Preston. Centauri comes from another planet. He was the inventor of the arcade game, and he was basically invented it as a testing device for future starfighters to recruit. Apparently, there's an interstellar war happening. We've got Zor and the Kodan Armada, you know, trying to take over the universe, and Earth is threatened, and Centauri comes along and introduces himself to Alex and says, just pulls up to him and says, "Hey man, get in my car, I got candy." And of course Alex gets in, and he takes him to space and shows him what's going on, and the idea that there's a line in there, a throwaway line, where Centauri says that the arcade game wasn't even meant to show up in his trailer park in the middle of buttfuck nowhere. And I think he said it was supposed to go to Vegas or something like that.
So they probably are, like, Nevada or Arizona.
Yeah. So it just happened to work out that Alex Rogan beats the machine. And is recruited by Centauri to join this fight. Now let's talk about Robert Preston real quick here, because this was a very very on-point performance from Preston. It was a very touching performance, and it was a very humorous performance, and one of the highlights of the film, of course, and he played it kind of as a nod to his role in as Harold Hill in The Music Man.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not sure if it was written to be that way. I mean, he's a very sort of, like, affable roguish con artist figure. And so, you know, I would not be surprised, because Alex basically has two sort of father figures here in Centauri, and we'll talk about Grig later.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, he's, like, the more tricky one. And that also goes with sort of the framework this film is built on, because it's very much inspired by The Once and Future King, with Alex's Arthur, and Centauri is very much, like, a trickster Merlin type. They even bring up, when they're at the base, if they say something to Centauri, like, "Have you been playing your Excalibur games again?" Like, he's been finding chosen ones, like, through these weird tests for an extremely long period of time, it seems to be implying. Maybe that he's, like, legitimately Merlin. so, yeah, I mean, he's basically playing Harold Hill in space, which is awesome. I mean, it's, you know, one of the all-time, like, great musical characters, like, a completely definitive, iconic character. And, yeah, he's playing to that type. And it's a great performance. He's funny, and, you know, he's just, like, smarmy and desperate enough to not totally trust him, but yeah, there's a real warmth about him.
He gets totally he gets offended when Alex turns down the offer and wants to go home, and Centauri, you know, throws a fit and reluctantly drives him home and cops an attitude with him the whole way. that's got to be a very uncomfortable flight back to Earth when the guy driving you is pissed off at you.
So awkward, and you know, he's repairing his like star car out in the middle of the desert. He's a very down on his luck, aging like salesman type.
Yeah.
So, which is the Music Man, like, and it totally works here. You know, it's such an interesting sort of mashup, like that this could have been, you know, a very generic hero's journey, but just having that, and on some level there is that like. It does have that very traditional once in future king hero's journey structure, but yeah, the fact like something that, you know, I think like a lot of modern blockbusters missed out on was the trickster mentor, and you know, Centauri's a great, it like re-envisioning the Music Man has that in space is a stroke of genius.
Yeah. Another stroke of genius for this movie was the fact that in order to alleviate any suspicion of Alex's disappearance, Centauri leaves behind a beta or a robot to replace Alex, and that, you know, brought a lot of comedy to the story as Beta gets used to you know, Earth customs. One of the funnier scenes is when Beta is actually out at the lake with Maggie, Catherine Mary Stewart, and she's not comfortable with some of the stuff that he's doing as they're making out, and she turns her back on him, and he's overhearing a conversation, you know, nearby of a guy who's trying to kiss and make up with his girlfriend. And you know, he's repeating verbatim everything that the guy is saying to try and get back into her, Maggie's good graces, including all those other girls never meant a thing to me. And so that was you know, a lighter moment in the film, you know, courtesy of and that was a dual role by Lance Guest playing both Beta Alex and, you know, regular Alex. And the interesting thing about that is learning that when production wrapped up, Lance Guest went out and got a haircut, and they needed him back for some additional work in post production. And so you can kind of tell in the film where Beta Alex is actually wearing a wig, because his hairstyle looks a little different than regular Alex. And so
it is noticeable. I mean, yeah. It's not like, you know, Kate Mara in the 2015 Fantastic Four noticeable, but it's pretty notable. Yeah, I know they did more with Beta Alex because there was a really positive audience response with those scenes, and they wanted to film more, a couple more moments, just to give the audience a little bit more.
Yeah.
Which totally works. I mean, I honestly think, like, you know, a lot of people are sort of down by that filmmaking by committee, but you know, I think that if you're trying to make like a crowd pleasing kind of film, like discovering that an element you didn't really give much consideration is actually a bigger presence to the audience. Like adding more, if you can do that without sacrificing the through line of the film, like, and I think this film, it definitely doesn't hurt the film at all. Especially because because Alex, as he's written, and this is not Lance Guest's fault, but he's written to be a very whiny character.
Yeah. No, he is. His situation is basically he wants to leave the trailer park. He doesn't want to get stuck in the trailer park the rest of his life. He's trying to get into a good college and not the crappy little city college that he mocks at one point in the film. And when he gets his loan rejection letter, I mean, he thinks that's the end of his life. And so, I mean, it's understandable. He wants more for himself, but, he's...
That stuff is all perfectly fine. I'm mostly thinking about, I think they just... There's too much in the middle portion of the film about him, like, refusing to be part of this war.
Right.
And then,
yeah.
Like, and
yeah.
Not, we're not really given... like a big enough sort of a big enough reason for him to go back into the war. We find out later that his other mentor character, his family, is currently being enslaved, but we find that out while he's already in the fighting. I feel like finding that out and then deciding he's gotta help would have been like that sort of linchpin scene to make us really empathize with the character.
Yeah, and I see what you're talking about, and I agree with that. You know, he's he was very reluctant. You know, I think much further along in the film than the typical plot for a film of this genre probably would have allowed.
Yeah, it does have some pacing issues where that's concerned.
Yeah. We're at the point then in the story then where he gets the offer to join the resistance and he refuses, and Centauri takes him back home reluctantly, and Alex and Beta Alex meet, and there's comedy, hilarity ensues, and there's alien hitmen that arrive on the planet to try and take them both out, and then that's when Alex sees the situation as it is, and we head back into space. Centauri without giving too much away, he gets hurt in the process, but we meet Grig, his Gunstar companion, Grig, played by Dan O'Hurley.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of his. I mean, of course, the old man in RoboCop, Connell Cochran in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch,
uh-huh.
And actually Macduff in the Orson Welles Macbeth.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I don't know about much about Dan's early career, but I'm assuming he was a stage actor early on. He certainly got the voice and presence of one, and
yeah.
I'm sure that's probably how he ended up in the Welles Macbeth. So Dan is unrecognizable because he is under a ton of makeup here.
Oh yeah, he looks basically like a lizard man, essentially.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And it's a ton of you can't recognize him. The only way you recognize him is if you stick around and read the credits and you find out it was him. His name pops up in the opening credits and you're like, "Oh, hey, Connell Cochran's in this." And you're waiting and waiting and like, "Where is he?" He's under all that makeup. And the one appealing thing about Grig, though, is what I liked about him is his the looseness about him. You know, the way he laughed at everything. His laugh was very, very wheezy kind of laugh. And the fact that he laughed at a lot of stuff just made him a much more appealing character. I think he brought some levity to the scenes with Alex, where Alex is all mopey dopey, and Grig is he kind of learns some life lessons from Grig there.
Yeah, Grig becomes his other father figure, is more steady, like stately father figure. Even though Grig is he's clearly a respected pilot and military leader, but he's also funny. He laughs he's got that very sort of sardonic humor about the situation they're up against. I mean, they're impossible odds, and he's almost got he's not as boisterous as Brian Blessed, but he's got that sort of you know, Blood Knight sense of humor, like, yeah, we're just gonna fight everyone. It's just us.
Like, yeah.
Dan Hurley is such presence, and his voice has such presence. It's such, like, a friendly voice, but, like, a dignified voice, and it's, like, there's, you know, humor underlying everything he says. He is, like, a great Levening influence, because Lance, you know, it's a shame Lance in the, like, main Alex role couldn't have harnessed some of the humor he brings out in Beta. Yeah. Alex, I kept wondering what, like, yeah, I know, like, why they cast him, because he's, like, a young everyman, he's got, like, those really wide, sensitive eyes, like, you know, they do a lot, like, in Dark, and which helps a lot, because sometimes he's got the helmet on, and you can still, like, see those eyes react to things, and, like, you know, in dark nighttime scenes at the trailer park, like, they tend to focus on those a lot. I kept wondering, like, what a more adaptable or manic actor would have done with that. Like, I kept thinking of Tom Villard, Toby from Popcorn.
Yeah.
And, like, who has, like, physically not a dissimilar look to Lance, but has much more personality in his voice, and can do, and, you know, a lot of energy to burn off. I kept, like, just imagining what he would have done with this role. I know that feels like sort of hypercritical of Lance, who I don't think was bad in this, but I think wasn't really able to fight against some of the flaws in the script where his character is concerned.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I actually I'll go one step further with this and say that I actually thought Beta Alex, the robot Alex, was much more human acting than regular Alex.
No, he's much more engaging. Like, regular, yeah, Alex is just written to hit those, like, really specific hero's journey beats. Like, I also kept wondering, like, what if, like, you sort of reverse the roles? Like, you don't even need, like, I guess you'd have to have, like, a Beta kind of character until you do the reveal that, oh, it's not the real one. But what if, instead of, and not that they would have done this in 1984, but what if Catherine Mary Stewart was the last Starfighter? I mean, she's, like, I feel like she could pull that off really, really well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Lance was just kind of the hapless boyfriend stuck at home with, like, thinking his girlfriend's turned all weird on him.
And, you know, Beta Alex actually, there's a scene where he actually sacrifices himself to save the mission. You know, we've got the Zandozan, the alien hitmen who are trying to send a message back to the mothership about, you know, the last Starfighter actually, you know, actually being, you know, in the Gunstar, you know, in space, and that the Beta Alex is the decoy. He drives the truck through the communication device, and, you know, blowing everything up and killing himself in the process. And I really think that was, like, much more heroic than regular Alex in his Gunstar trying to figure out strategy on how to tackle the Armada on his own.
Yeah, I mean, we get some decent moments in the Gunstar. I mean, you know, space battles are definitely fun, although it's a weird sort of dynamic when you've just got one ship on the good guy's side. I felt like some of the battles seemed a little anticlimactic because we don't really, like, all the destruction on the bad guy's part is front-loaded in when they, like, bomb the headquarters.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, these aren't really comparable to, I know that's what they're going for, because that's like an 80s video game, that's an Atari game, that's Galaga and Galaxian and, you know, Asteroids and, yeah, a million other games of this stripe, where you've got one ship against, like, waves and waves of enemies. So that's what they are trying to evoke. But I just kept thinking of, you know, the very sort of dogfight battles in the Star Wars films, and how they ratchet up the tension by sacrificing, like, Porkins and aliens and, you know, Porkins. But but yeah, so I mean, it's a different. They had to make do with a different style of battle, and I don't think it was always effective. I think, like, there's a lot of cool battle scenes, but I think it's mostly, I'm mostly there because Grig is so interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about the battle scenes, and more specifically the special effects in this film. This was, you know, you had Disney put out Tron, I think, a couple of years before The Last Starfighter. And so with Tron, Last Starfighter is it's one of the earliest examples of CGI in a movie. I mean, they used the CGI to depict the starships, some of the environments and the battle scenes. So what did you think of the early CGI in this movie? I mean, you could tell where it was. And yeah, I mean, did I thought it was fine. As, I mean, it's 1984, and of course, 1984 audiences are still being wowed by special effects that they've seen in Star Wars and whatnot. It's certainly not the CGI in The Last Starfighter. Certainly not on the level of, you know, what you see now in like things like Lord of the Rings and, you know, your Marvel movies and whatnot. But yeah, it's still very primitive at this point, but I thought it was quite good for, you know, what was for the time frame.
Yeah, I mean, it's very noticeable, of course. I think it even would have been in that era. I think what they're up against is like unlike Tron, where Tron had such heavy stylization that, you know, you could just buy into it as the style. Like, even though this is evoking a video game aesthetic, like, it's still in the real world, so you've got it. So they're still working against, like, having to be realistic with very limited computing power to do this.
Yeah.
So, like, I think there's enough tactile stuff in this film where I don't think it was a problem, because obviously, like, there's a lot of focus in the battles of inside cockpit shots. And I think that totally works, because actually the setup in the cockpit is really works really well. You've got Grig in the navigator seat and Alex in the gunnery seat, which works really well because his display is actually probably the best effect in the film. He's got like a computer display that looks like, you know, when you compare like the computer display in the first Star Wars, it looks so much better. Like, and they have this cool detail where you have to look at it straight on because it's sort of like a floating gas inside this glass or plexiglass or whatever screen. And it actually reminded me of a recent Gundam series, Gundam Unicorn, where there's like inside the cockpit are these like big HD computer screens around the pilot of these mechas in the series.
Okay.
And like you're sort of turning with the cockpit like in this 360 degree like rotational view, and it kind of reminded me of like an early version of that. So that was actually a really compelling effect, which is interesting because it's just a computer screen. But you know, I think what helps is just that level of detail. It's suspended gas, you have to look at it straight on. Like that lent it a tactile quality that might not have had otherwise.
Yeah, and definitely. So, you know, the special effects and of course the some of the practical effects in the film were used as well, especially in the scene where the Beta unit is actually under the covers, in bed under the covers, and it's turning into Alex. You know, there was a practical effect used there.
That must have given so many kids nightmares, dude. I mean, that was like actually surprisingly gruesome.
Yeah, you've this pale skinned, gooey looking body with bug eyes sticking out of a still unformed skull, and so I mean, yeah, it was kind of almost like a horror effect.
Yeah, no, it really was. And one of the major makeup department guys on this is Lance Anderson, who worked on Rob Bottin's crew on the John Carpenter thing. And yeah, he was still early in his career. He had just done been one of the makeup artists on the Thriller video. Yeah, he would later work on Captain EO and Moonwalker, Pet Sematary, Shocker. Yep. Guy with a lot of credits who, as far as I know, is still working. I think was nominated for an Oscar at some point. I forget what film it might have been when he worked on L.A. Confidential. But yeah, so he was nominated for makeup for Cinderella Man, not L.A. Confidential.
Okay.
But so probably for all like the bruising makeup, everything in that makes sense. It's one of the shames so that we don't get like the other pilots lasting longer, is that the makeup effects are just maybe a half step below Rick Baker's stuff in Star Wars. I mean, these are really great creatures.
Yeah, you had the there was a friendly alien that was conversing with Alex, and then of course the tentacle alien. Alex steps on one of his tentacles and he gets all mad at him. Start spewing gibberish at him.
I loved him.
Yeah, those aliens, the effects there, the makeup was pretty good, and to go along with the the early form of CGI. So this was a very special effects laden story, and I thought it was very well made on all respects.
Oh, absolutely. The makeup effects are very strong. You know, I thought the special effects for early CGI, I mean, they're very obviously I'm sure they would have been then, but I think, you know, there's a level of scope and definition to them that I think still works well. I mean, it's not shoddy. It's archaic, but it's not shoddy. I think is the thing. No, it's a film that, also, brief thing, they were actually, Gloob, I believe, was originally going to do line of action figures, but that sort of fell through because they weren't sure how successful the film would be.
Right, yeah.
Which is a shame because this is a very toyetic movie. Like, I would have loved a toy of the Gunstar.
Yeah, I think, on that same respect, I think Atari was going to release a version of this game for their 2600.
And I think they actually did a mock-up, I'm not sure if the prototype still exists, of an actual arcade unit, which I'm sure it would have looked exactly like the one in the movie, except they might have changed the very conspicuously Atari-like logo on the unit to the actual Atari logo.
Yeah, exactly. So I think one of the things that we were talking about, we were talking about. This genre of films in the 80s, The Last Starfighter came out. You've got E.T., and then, about a year later, Back to the Future comes out. A lot of these family-friendly, big-budget sci-fi wonders. And I mean, where does The Last Starfighter rank exactly with the rest of these films?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting bridge between the very heartwarming E.T. stuff and the adventurous Star Wars stuff and the later comedic Back to the Future stuff. I think it was a success when it came out, not a success in the level of those movies, obviously, but still a successful film. But yeah, I mean, it came out at a weird point because the Star Wars trilogy had ended. I think audiences were. Judging by the fact that the toy line was running its course and about finished, audiences had sort of been burnt out on space adventure by that point. So, this still had its fans, but I think probably didn't reach as many people as it would have a couple of years before, especially because we're also talking about a video game based movie a year after the great video game crash.
Yeah.
So it's a very poorly timed film, not through any fault of the filmmaker's own, of course. It just happened to come out at the worst possible time for this movie, but it was still managed to be a success. Obviously, special effects wise, although it does some very good things, it doesn't quite hold up to the Star Wars trilogy. But that's not surprising. I think it's a good movie. It's definitely not as good as I think it could have been with some script tightening, especially around the Alex character, because they were very consciously, I think, going for the hero's journey. Like, here's the problem: the whole movie, he's almost like doing the power converters line from Star Wars. But it's got enough weirdness to really differentiate with like Beta Alex and with Centauri. Like, I almost feel like they accidentally predicted the sci-fi, like the big budget, like sci-fi comedy. Like, I mean, it was the same year as Ghostbusters, but they couldn't have known about that probably. It was a year before Back to the Future. It's like they accidentally predicted where it was going to go, but they didn't quite get there.
Yeah. And in terms of success, you got a budget of about $15 million. A lot of that, of course, spent on special effects like CGI and whatnot. But and its North American returns came back well over $28 million. So, I mean, it made money. In North America alone, it's just shy of, making its money back plus, twice that. And I guess it can be termed to be, a minor success for Universal, who distributed it. So I think in the end, The Last Starfighter gets lost in the shuffle with all of the other big budget sci-fi movies that came out before it and a little after it. It tends to get forgotten.
Yeah, it does a bit. I think what keeps it in people's memories is the plot is fairly unique. I mean, even though obviously it's a takeoff, a very conscious takeoff on Sword in the Stone kind of legends. Getting the hero's call through playing an arcade game is pretty great wish fulfillment. And actually, I mean, people are still referencing stuff from this film every now and then. We didn't really mention the special button on the Gunstar.
Yeah, the Death Blossom.
Which was referenced as recently as the popular game Overwatch. One of the characters, Reaper, his big, like, move in it is like a sort of 360 twirling like barrage of gun of shooting that is called the Death Blossom.
Yeah,
just like the ship in this. So obviously Last Starfighter still has, I feel like if there were more, had been more merchandise, if that action figure line had come out, it'd probably still be a little more present in people's minds. But I think it's one that, like, just for the great supporting characters, is probably due for some kind of reappreciation.
Yeah, don't say remake.
You would never would never recapture. Also, like, what's both going up against and what it sort of presages. Of course, a couple of years ago we had a movie of Ender's Game, and this is, I don't know if they're aware of the novel, which I think was a 70s publication. I don't remember exactly when that came out, but with a sort of similar, although darker plot.
Yeah.
Ender's Game was for years heralded as I thought that was earlier than it was. It is that came out a year after Last Starfighter. They should sue Orson Scott Card. Everyone should just sue Orson Scott Card because he's a homophobe and a terrible human being. But no, so I mean, I'm wondering if maybe the imminent release of Ready Player One is not gonna.
I was gonna make mention of Ready Player One. Steven Spielberg's big movie that's due out probably around spring of 2018. There's supposed to be some very similar parallels between Ready Player One and The Last Starfighter.
So I, you know, Ready Player One, I would not be surprised if it inspires some people to look back at the last Starfire because of a bit of a similar plot. The plot's not totally similar, but the basic conceit, like, you know, video game skills translating to a larger epic scope adventure does have similarities.
Yeah. So, it's, I guess, something to look forward to in 2018 for Ready Player One. I mean, it's definitely, you know, parallels from what I understand to the last Starfighter, but the last Starfighter actually has kind of like a Spielbergian feel to it, like you mentioned earlier. So,
By this point, like, that sort of blockbuster style had been very codified. I mean, you know, there are variations on it. Obviously, earlier Back to the Future would take a more comedic view of it. But yeah, you've got so many similar things. You've got dysfunctional families that are, like, you know, financially struggling. You've got like a young everyman who finds, like, something uniquely supernatural or otherworldly in a surprising and often mundane place. Like, he finds that someone has been dreaming of more, or just dreaming of a reprieve from sort of how mundane and dreary his life is. I mean, this is stuff like, you know, Gremlins worked on this. Back to the Future, in its own way, worked with that. So, E.T., so many of these films work off that basic structure. So it's interesting to see, like, going from Flash Gordon to this, like, going from all the other Star Wars-inspired films to Last Starfighter, how long it took people to... Because there were so many Star Wars ripoffs, and they were all very, like... Flash Gordon is its own thing, of course, and, like, you know, a lot of them were very, like, sort of middling films with very, like, very boring plots that were just trying to hit the adventure beats and just didn't hit it that well. You know, the exception I can think of most readily, aside from Flash Gordon, is Battle Beyond the Stars, because that hitched itself to an older plot structure, the Seven Samurai structure.
Right, yeah.
Last Starfighter is a bit Star Wars and the hero's journey thing, but, you know, the background, the scope of it is more the feel, the tone, it's more Spielbergian. I mean, and now that we're in a sort of Spielberg renaissance again, with everyone, like, for years ripping off, like, E.T., like, and that tone, like, Last Starfighter might end up getting a bit more notice in the aftermath of that, but who knows?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, The Last Starfighter, and this is the part where I recommend it or not, but yeah, I like The Last Starfighter. I enjoyed it. You know, it's a change of pace in terms of more adult-oriented films that I enjoy. This one was definitely more family-friendly, but it didn't really dumb it down to where... everyone talk like an idiot, which some of these movies tend to do. And I enjoyed it for what it was, and, you know, the early CGI, you know, was kind of an interesting little footnote to it. I mean, because we've come a long way in terms of special effects now, and it's always good to see you where the beginnings of the CGI craze were, and, you know, the Last Starfighter has the distinction of being one of the earliest films to use it. I really enjoyed the secondary characters, Centauri and Grig, you know, Robert Preston and Dan O'Hurley, really, you know, added, you know, some levity to the material and made it humorous. And in the end, it's a success story. You know, you've got this guy who, you know, really wants to leave the trailer park, and, you know, he kind of has a roadblock to that, but he literally leaves the trailer park at the end of the film, and, you know, it's a happy ending all around. He gets the girl, and everybody wins in the end. So, yeah, I love The Last Starfighter, and I can give it a solid recommendation here as well.
Yeah, I mean, I do recommend it as like a fun, goofy like example of sort of a would-be blockbuster. You know, films adapting that structure with fewer resources to make a blockbuster on, sort of not quite like an indie or low-budget film, not quite a B movie, but, you know, as an example of those sort of like middle of the road attempts at doing something bigger than your resources. It's a pretty interesting little film that like is mostly bolstered by its cast. The weird details and, you know, the concept and the supporting cast are all what work for me most. The main sort of through line of it feels a bit anticlimactic and just not as well thought out or well executed as it could have been. Like, it's the weird, like, quirky and comedic elements of this that work for me the best.
Yeah. And so there you have it. The Last Starfighter from 1984, along with Flash Gordon. Perfect double bill for you to check out. Well, Joel, you know, all this, you know, good-natured fun with these movies we've been talking about deserves... some type of turnaround. I think let's rant here just for a few minutes to close out the show, because there's something that we want to, you know, touch on that is kind of sticking in our collective craws here a little bit. As everyone knows, Justice League opened up this past weekend. I guess as of the recording of this podcast, it had grossed about $96 million in North America. Worldwide total of about $280 million. The production budget for this thing was about $300 million. 24th biggest opening of all time. 24th. That's not bad. Nothing to shake at, you know?
It's really kind of meaningless now, like, even getting on those lists, though, like, because, like, with ticket prices, and I'm not sure if that's adjusted for inflation or not, but, I mean, like, you know, it's also a different film culture in terms of opening weekend is so vitally important now, like, with so much blockbuster competition. I mean, it's not, and it has been for a couple decades at least, but it's not, like, in the era where films were expected, like, hit films were expected to have a long run at theaters. I mean, even successful ones are out of theater in like 6 weeks.
Right. And so, but I want to point out the financials and from the respect that, you know, people are going to see the movie. Here's the thing, though. Do you check out the tomato meter, Joel? Do you do that often?
I do that every now and then. I don't see a lot of new films in theaters. Is the problem? I'm always interested to see like what responses are to new films, but for the most part, like, and you know, doubly so in the case of something where the response looks to be polarizing. I mean, with a new Marvel film, you can usually assume how the response is going to be. Like, it's like, and there's generally a critic audience consensus on something like that, or say most new Pixar films, like, there's generally a consensus between critics and audiences and a positive one at that. But, you know, something that tends to be that looks to be a bit more fractious or contentious, like Justice League obviously was always going to be, really intrigues me.
Yeah, well, the current tomato meter for Justice League sits at 40%. 237 reviews counted, 94 of them fresh, 40%. That is a Rotten Tomato. That is a big green splat next to its percentage point there. Now, what gets me about this is that there are a lot of people who use the tomato meter as, I guess, the final say in determining whether or not they are going to see a movie. And with a Justice League film or a DC film, you're going to get the fanboys. We'll call them the fanboys because that's what they are, who take contention with the tomato meter score of their favorite movies. So at this point with DC, we've had Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, and the best reviewed one of the lot so far, of course, Wonder Woman.
The only one I've seen.
And I can admit to have not seen any of them at this point. I don't know. I've just spent much more time on older films. That's just the way things work out. Nothing against the DC films. There are some Marvel films I have not seen yet also, so just to play fair here. Because I know that there's a whole DC versus Marvel war going on here across internet boards.
Which conglomerates are going to get your money?
Exactly.
That's important.
DC fanboys take contention with the fact that their movies are getting poor reviews and the Marvel films are getting rave reviews. You know, most recent example is Thor Ragnarok, currently sits at 92%. And, the fanboys, the DC fanboys think that there's some sort of conspiracy going on, that, you know, that it's intentional that, you know, their films are the ones getting knocked and whatnot. And but here's the thing, and here's the point I'm getting at. And for the people who get on Rotten Tomatoes and they look up the score of a current release and they use that score to determine whether or not they're going to see the movie, if you're seeing a trailer for this film and maybe you're not a fanboy, maybe you're just a casual moviegoer, and you know, you go to the big blockbusters, and every year you've got two or three Marvel movies to choose from, and plus other blockbusters outside of that realm. But if you're excited to see this film based on a trailer, and then you can't wait for it to come out, and it's finally released, and boom, it gets a bad score, why are people allowing the critical consensus of a film to deter them from going to a movie? You can go to a film. I'm of the belief that you can go to a film and enjoy it on your own terms, whether or not anyone else liked it or hated it. I mean, people could just walk out of the theater in disgust in front of you, but if you're enjoying it, man, that's one hell of a ride. And you and I, Joel, we both, you know, we love some really awful, horrible films, both in terms of quality and the content in the film. But, and that's just, you know, our opinion. You know, we love a movie. I love Pet Sematary. A lot of people hate Pet Sematary. I love it for, you know, reasons. I want to be entertained when I'm watching a film, and, you know, a lot of these films have entertained me, and I can promise you that if I sit down in front of Man of Steel or Batman versus Superman or Wonder Woman or Justice League, I am going to I'm probably going to find something to enjoy in that film. I'm probably going to walk away and say, hey, you know what, it wasn't that bad, you know, it's not as horrible. And I'll go home and check the tomato meter score, and It did horrible with critics, and I'm like, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. But, I mean, that's as far as I take it. But just to direct your rage at whether it's Rotten Tomatoes or critics or whoever that trash a movie that you have enjoyed, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And that's the rant that I really want to make, is why allow – outside influences spoil your fun.
Well, you know, I have my sympathies because, like, dumb fangs have hurt my enjoyment of things before. If you've ever watched Steven Universe and tried to enjoy it, knowing about its fandom, it's difficult. But you know, with critics, there's a lot of things going on here, both specific to Justice League and in general. First of all, blockbuster film watching has been a team sport for a long time. Like, look at the death threats given to anyone who has ruined, like, a 100% tomato meter score. The shit Armin White took. Armin is a contrarian, and he's often glaringly wrong, and sometimes he's really insightful. And it's kind of hard to dig through his stuff, finding the moments that are, but I do have an appreciation for Armin's work. You know, when he ruined Toy Story 3's Rotten Tomato score, or, you know, when people have ruined, like, the perfect tomato score for The Avengers, speaking of Joss Whedon. But, I mean, and this is a very sort of specific case, because people, for some reason, have invested so much of themselves into hoping that DC, and maybe it's just pre-existing love of the characters, or maybe it's, you know, they liked the dark tone of the Zack Snyder films, which they're going to get a real surprise with Justice League, because it's very clearly apparent, according to every source that's seen it, and to get away from that. I mean, you know, I'm less bothered by good or bad reviews for the DC's movies than how flailing their attempts at making these movies are. They have, aside from Wonder Woman, which was, to be fair, aside from Suicide Squad, the only one I've actually watched all the way through. But, like, they're clearly in a mode where they're trying to listen to fans, and that's great, but they're upending the entire films. I mean, reshooting tons and tons of things, spending so much money, spending millions and millions of dollars on reshoots, when it's like, if you just had a plan going in.
Yeah.
And obviously the plan was not good. The Zack Snyder plan was not working. So, because Zack Snyder is dark, but the darker you get with inherently ridiculous material, the better you have to be. Zack Snyder is not that good a filmmaker. He's not that smart a person. Like, that's a dick thing to say, but he's not Alan Moore. You know, he's not, like, pre-insanity Frank Miller. He's not like, I don't know, Steve Gerber, or anyone who's done an interestingly dark comic with kid characters, basically. Right. And even those people have slipped up. Some more stuff is patently ridiculous because it tried to be too dark without doing it right, without modulating those tones. And, you know, mastery of tone is probably the most difficult part of telling a story. That's the most difficult part of writing for anybody in almost any fictional medium. So there's all sorts of tonal issues with these films that Marvel doesn't have, because they developed their house style a while ago, and I may not like it, but, you know, it fundamentally works for people. I didn't like the Christopher Nolan Batman films, but even being dark, they worked for people. Obviously, these films aren't... I want to see the audience tomato score for Justice League after the film's been out for 2 weeks. Right. After it's leveled out into what the general response was, and not the response of people who were really excited for a Justice League film. Right.
That audience score currently sits at 85%.
Which is wild. That's like...
And it's just shy of 100,000 votes.
Yeah. So I want to see the audience score after the people who have seen it, just because their kids dragged it to them over Thanksgiving weekend. Yeah. you know, I want the people who were like, oh, I liked Wonder Woman. I've heard bad things, but let me see if I like this. Like, you know, that's what I want to see. But that's very... What I'm talking about right now is sort of very specific to these films, and Warner Brothers' sort of constantly botched attempts to make these things work. You know, so much of it goes down to, like, our current blockbuster culture where, you know, they've gutted the middle, like, they've gutted the middle budget films and they just have blockbusters left to make money off of.
Right, yeah.
And so it's so important to these studios that these work, because at the very least work enough for people to buy all the ancillary media, all the action figures and video games and t-shirts and every tie-in, because that's where the films make most of their money. But so they've given the audience the illusion of choice, even though they have less and less choice of media viewing as years go on and media companies consolidate and streaming companies take over and focus on their own homegrown stuff. Like, there's less and less choice, but it's to Hollywood's benefit, to the entertainment industry's benefit, to convince us we've got more choice. It's like if the only sport available was the NFL and you're a diehard Eagles fan and that's what you got, you hate other teams that are infringing on the Eagles, but you know, all you know is football. There's no basketball or baseball or UFC or any or NASCAR or anything else. Like, that's kind of the situation now, is convincing the audience they have a choice, but the choice is which franchise to give your money to, rather than, like, how you want to, like, what kind of films you want, what kind of entertainment you want, how you, like, what kind of tones you want, or what kind of, how you, it's a choice of endless consumption, rather than a choice of thoughtful discussion, or, you know,
yeah,
entertainment that's really going to move you or speak to you. It's worse than the 80s, because what we talked about with, yeah, about that very codified Spielberg blockbuster style, it's worse than that ever was, because there was so much choice then. Video stores had so many, as ridiculous as it seems, your local mom and pop video store had, like, Netflix say has 6,000 titles in its library, which is, like, probably a little over half of what a larger video store had in its library. And a lot of Netflix's options are TV, and their TV is meant to be, I hate the term binge watching, and this is me really ranting now, but I hate the idea that entertainment is just meant to be relentlessly consumed and not rewatched, not revisited, yeah, not reinterpreted. Like,
the I mean, Netflix even uses it in, you know, in their ads. You know,
Netflix.
Well, they'll send out an email and they'll basically say, "Binge watch today," and it'll list their choices.
Well, that's why they put out full seasons at once, like it, because their job is to keep you on the hook. Like, that's why they don't even care if you're watching. Like, people have embraced, like, they've embraced Netflix and chill. They don't care. They don't care if you're, like, hooking up at the time. You're having a one night stand, as long as your Netflix is on in the background. Like, at this point, they'll probably create the option to have playlists meant for one night stands.
Ugh.
No, it's a relentlessly consumer-oriented game. Of course, it's always been, but, you know, where we are with the paucity of choices available to us compared to the, like, endless, like, depth of choices that could be available to us, and that, you know, during the golden age of DVD were available to us,
yeah,
is staggering. It's just like, you know, obviously it will never get to this point, but I just imagine a future where there's one show, it has every facet of entertainment everybody's ever liked, and it's just on constantly, and that's it. You have it's the Henry Ford thing where you can have any color you like as long as it's like, I was going to say House of Cards, but that one,
yeah.
As long as, like, Stranger Things. Or, I mean, Yeah, I'm harping on Stranger Things a lot because it's a bastardization of things I like.
I'm hoping that in the future that the Running Man comes to life, and we just have the 24/7 Running Man channel.
You know, that's one thing. Quick digression. I kind of love that we are wrong about the future. Is that sports have gotten like. And sports audiences have typically gotten more sensitive to the physical plight of athletes. Like, sports did not go rollerball. Sports actually softened up, which I think is honestly for the best. Because it turns out that sports-associated deaths aren't as exciting as the Running Man or rollerball. It's just, like, it's just years of mental degradation. And that's not visual.
Yeah.
You can't make a fun broadcast out of that.
Yeah. Thank you, concussions. You've ruined everything.
So,
well, that's just me. That's just me being facetious, of course.
I just find that interesting because we're in a society that more and more is divided over, and not that I'm like any kind of like. Fucking figurehead to be making big social pronouncements, but a society that's divided more and more into how sensitive to be. Like, you've got people who want to be more and more considerate and respectful of other people and their experiences and their feelings, and people who seemingly in response to that said, "Fuck it, I'm gonna be a dick."
Yeah, and you know, everyone's a snowflake. And...
Yeah. This is why you can't do satire anymore, speaking of that. That's good. Because nothing is so ridiculous that it won't be appropriated by the worst people. Fight Club is a novel and film criticizing toxic masculinity written by a gay man. And, like, the, like, ironically, macho language of that story has been co-opted by, like, internet warriors, the kind of internet warriors populating Reddit. And, you know, sending death threats to Zoe Quinn or, you know, tweeting out fake news from Russian box or whatever people are doing now. like just people who are making things worse.
Yeah, so, I mean, and then generally that's the bottom line of, you know, both of our rants on this topic is basically, you know, people's ability or inability to enjoy something on their own terms is basically you know what I was trying to strive for is everyone's different. I mean we don't have to all fall in line with one line of thinking. So I mean if you're interested in the movie, go see the fucking movie. And if you enjoy it, then, you know, don't let someone else's opinion who hasn't even seen it bring you down. And the same thing with, you know, movie critics. I mean, if a critic hates the movie that you enjoy, what's the point of arguing that? That's just someone else's opinion. And that's the whole thing about – and I guess it's a reflection of society in general is that everyone's opinions are wrong. No matter how right they are, everyone else's opinions about something is wrong, and that's why we get so argumentative as a society and divided.
Well, it's a mixture of stuff in my eyes because, like, so much of it is about, like, we're in a realm where, like, traditional forms of media are being distrusted, both for good and ill. Like, I understand because I just ranted about like the scarcity of choice available to us in our entertainment because it's profitable for companies to sell us the same things, pretend we have a choice but not really give us one.
Yeah.
Because that means we might buy things not from them. So obviously I've got a lot of cynicism and distrust towards media companies, but at the same time like. People, I think, have ingrained that kind of distrust to an unhealthy level because, like, and misdirected it because, like, they'll play sport, they'll play, like, favorites, they'll, you know, get involved in like their sports team style debates, their spectator sports debates over DC versus Marvel movies, or like, you know, just franchise versus franchise, and then they'll act like the critics are ruining their ability to have a choice. it's like kind of the same thinking that says, well, the media is not always accurate or not always truthful. They're owned by big companies. They might have an agenda to their news source, and exactly. then trusting an independent news source owned by billionaires with the intent of getting other billionaires into public office to make more money for billionaires.
Yeah,
like you turn away from something that's wrong, that might be wrong or biased, but has oversight, some level of oversight, to something that's totally corrupt and unhealthy. Like trusting Time Warner to give you the best movies on the basis that some critic was an asshole is like trusting a billionaire to give you cheaper health care on the basis that other politicians might be self-serving.
Yeah. And so we've tied our rant up into the White House. All right.
Just you know, there's a level at which thinking for yourself is great, and there's a level at which maybe you should be more diligent in how you go about that is the thing.
Like, yeah,
because as soon as you decide that like everyone in charge is automatically innately corrupt or wrong and has nothing accurate to say, that's when snake oil salesmen are ready to sell you something. That's when they're ready to convince you that you shouldn't eat gluten and you shouldn't get vaccines and you should vote for real estate developers who are totally in league with your personal interest, obviously.
Right, and you should totally binge watch The Punisher right after you binge watch Stranger Things.
You should just hook yourself up to, like, you know, one of those glucose packs they have in hospitals when you're in a coma. Just hook yourself up to that. Keep your mouth open, put a little cup underneath for your drool, and then watch your Stranger Things and Punisher, and then bitch about critics who don't like it because
that's,
they're trying to ruin your life.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I envision Netflix account holders right now at this time. Sorry. That's my opinion, and I'm going to stick to it.
Dude, I work among lawyers who do that. Like, there's... I know this is sounding like me being a snob or me being condescending or a million other things, but there's clearly, like, I don't think... Well, I was going to say I don't think there's any sort of, like, intellectual degradation going on in society, but I think there's sort of a degradation in how we take in information. We don't, like, we haven't learned enough about how to watch things properly. I know that sounds like some elitist bullshit, but because we've been taught our entire lives to just keep watching and keep consuming, we haven't, and God, I'm sounding like They Live right now. We haven't been taught how
obey.
To
obey.
We haven't been taught how to analyze properly.
Yeah.
And the more generations you go with no one knowing how to do that, the more susceptible you are to being taken advantage of by people who know how to exploit that. And I know it's just movies, it's just stupid blockbuster movies.
Yep.
But I honestly think it's symptomatic of people being just overwhelmed by information and not knowing how to analyze what they're receiving.
Exactly.
They turn to what they trust, and what they trust is what's familiar.
Right. And I think that's a good point to end on there, Joel, because you know, that pretty much sums up the situation that you know, we're trying to hammer home. So once again, Joel, bringing the goodness to go home in the box. I appreciate all your input, man.
Like, you know, just a quick thing. I appreciate yours too, man. Something Tucker Stone, one of my favorite critics, once said, you think DC makes the best Batman comics? They make the only Batman comics.
Yeah.
So, like, seriously, you don't have to... No one has to accept what's in front of them. You think Justice League sucks? Don't blame the critics. Go out and you buy yourself an Aquaman figure and you act out your own Justice League.
Yeah, actually, that's a good way to go. Yeah.
That's what I'm going to be doing for Thanksgiving.
He talks to fish.
I talk to fish.
That's his only line. You're playing with your action figures and Batman and Robin need an assist. Let's call Aquaman. And Aquaman comes in, and here comes Aquaman waddling along, and the line you give him, hey, everybody, I talk to fish.
Listen, my Aquaman figure is on top of a great white shark toy. My Aquaman figure is irrefutably awesome.
Yeah.
Forget Batman. He's just a rich kid who experienced consequences and is waging war on the underclass his entire life. No, Batman is like, he might as well be Steve Bannon. Aquaman is a true freedom fighter.
All right, Joel, eagerly anticipating that Aquaman movie.
I'm not, but I will be making my own.
With that said, we conclude another fantastic edition of Go Home in the Box. Thank you, Joel, as always. And for Joel, myself, Chris Jordan, thank you, and Aquaman, thank you for listening. Hell of a show. And join us again for the next one. We will see you next time.